You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of my best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. Now, in today's episode, I like to talk about sweating the small stuff. And by that, I mean making an active decision that we're going to try and influence the things that we have some level of influence over. And this conversation takes place in the wider, you know, acceptance of the fact that many of the things that happened to us or the way that our life has taken form, you know, a lot of that really wasn't within our realm of control. And by that, I mean things like, you know, what country you're born into, which obviously has a massive effect on just the general opportunities that you're going to be given. It's going to have an effect on your cultural outlook. It's going to have an effect on the kind of person that you are. So imagine, for example, even just being born in a different part of town. Let's say you live in the UK. Think about the difference in outlook and experience you're going to have by being born in London or being born in the country somewhere. So country or the place that you're born is one thing. Another thing is just like the family you're born into. So whether you're born into a wealthy family, a middle-class family, a poor family, obviously we know that those factors have a massive impact on where you go to school, on whether you go to university, if you go to university, the kinds of degrees you opt for. And then beyond that point, it affects your employment attainment, it affects how much money you're going to have. And it also, on a psychological level, it even just affects your aspirations. So for example, if you are born into a family of nurses, chances are you're going to aspire to being a nurse. If you're a family of bus drivers, you're going to aspire to driving a bus. I mean, not necessarily always, but it just makes it much more likely. So meaning that the people that you are born into and around end up affecting just your outlook, even as far as the things that you dare to dream about. Another thing that affects your life that you didn't choose is even just being born in a specific era. So imagine the difference in quality of life for, you know, a 25-year-old woman being born in 1992 or being born in 1942. It has a massive impact on the things that she's going to think about herself. It has an impact on the kinds of options she will have in terms of like partnership, in terms of whether she can work, in terms of whether she can have her own money. So even something like just arbitrarily being born 50 years ago or 50 years into the future has a massive impact. And then another thing that sometimes we don't think about, it's even just like your basic physical and cognitive ability. If you're born like 6'2" and have a propensity for basketball or have a natural God-given, if you will, talent for basketball or any other skill set, then it obviously puts you in a very different position than somebody who's born like, you know, 5 foot and has no hand-eye coordination. Or outside the sports realm, even just imagine what it means to be born with incredibly good looks. You know, that makes your whole experience of life on this earth a little bit smoother. Or even when you're born with a basic talent, like having like an amazing voice. Like think about somebody like Celine Dion or Adele, who just happened to have been born with like these incredible lungs that basically mean that people fawn over them when they open their mouths to sing. And that has affected the things that they've been able to do with their lives. And again, it's not things that they've decided to do. It's literally like the luck of the draw. And not to say that people don't work hard. It's not they don't work hard, it's that people in the same position with different circumstances or different attributes, no matter how hard they work, would never have those things just because they happen to have been born under different circumstances and with different skill sets and different abilities. So when you think about, you know, the location you're born, the family you're born into, the era you're born into, the basic sort of physical and cognitive abilities that you have, you know, those factors, along with many other factors, are things that you can't control. Now, that doesn't mean that we throw our hands up and say, well, so much is against me or so many things I don't have a control over and why bother? It actually just means, one, not being so harsh with yourself, because ultimately so many of these things have already been decided before you even get a voice in the matter of how to sort of shape your life. But there are other small things that may not affect the macro view of your life, but individually and taken together, they do have an effect on how you feel about yourself, on how other people interact with you, and also in how your outlook ends up being affected by whether you choose to do these things or believe these things about yourself. And that's what I'd like to talk about in the episode. So I'll start with small things and move on to bigger things. And one of the small things that I think about all the time is even just like the effect of being a punctual person. So some people are always on time, and they, you know, if you tell them to meet you at 2 o'clock, they're going to be there like 1:45, or worst case scenario, they're going to be like 2 o'clock, not 2:01, not 2:05, not 2:30. They're going to be there on the nose because they've decided to be there on time. Like, that's their identity. They're a punctual person. And the thing about punctuality is that whether you're late or on time is not a neutral action, and it has knock-on effects, not only to the people who are interacting with you, but also knock-on effects on how you perceive yourself. One of the things is, I don't know if you've had the experience of arriving like late to work, and you haven't arrived late to work because, you know, you ran into something unexpected, or, you know, somebody needed your help on the street and you had to stop and help them and that delayed you, or there was like train strikes you weren't anticipating, or there was like some kind of natural disaster that meant that there was no way you're going to get there on time. Like, most of the time we don't get there despite having the same day every single day, like Monday to Friday, or, you know, whatever your schedule is. And chances are you have to be there at the same time every day. So it's never a surprise about like what your schedule is going to be. So when you get there late, like, one, you're hot and sweaty and bothered, and automatically you just don't communicate somebody who's in control of their lives because you are literally out of control. You had the capacity and the opportunity to control exactly what time you got there because you have the same schedule every day. And for you to arrive late, it does mean that either there's poor planning going on, or there's a resistance into going into work or being there on time. But the message of showing up hot and sweaty and bothered and having the same excuse over and over again, or even just having to lie and make up stuff because it's so embarrassing being the perpetually late person, all that communicates I'm out of control to the people who are experiencing your lateness. And ultimately, there are adjectives associated with people who are punctual, and there are adjectives associated with people who are not punctual, people who are late. The people who are punctual are associated with discipline and being in control, being respectful of other people's time. And the people who are late, perpetually late, are associated with bad adjectives like being out of control, being undisciplined, being disrespectful of other people's time, being lazy, or generally just being out of control. And because we know that, each time we repeat that negative action, we're going through that reinforcement mechanism of the environment around us communicating those negative adjectives. Because most of the time when you show up late, people don't embrace you and say, oh, it's so good to see you, and, you know, I'm so excited to be sharing a space with you, and I can't wait for dinner, or I can't wait to work with you. No, like, usually they're irritated because you're so, if it's a workplace situation, your manager or your place of work expected you to be there at 9 o'clock, and here you are rolling in at 9:28, sweating and with another excuse for the 25th time. Or if you're meeting a friend or a loved one, then they've been sitting waiting for you at the place you arranged to meet last week, and you're half an hour late, and it's not the first time, and you both know it's also not going to be the last time. And ultimately, you're internalizing that message. You're internalizing, I mess up, I'm out of control, I'm undisciplined, everybody else can get there on time, but for some reason, I can't find it in myself. Despite telling myself this is the last time I'm going to be late, I still end up repeating that bad behavior. So we're internalizing this negative messaging that may seem like a small thing, but it actually does affect your self-perception or the idea of yourself. And also on another level, it affects your self-esteem. I've had experiences where I've been very early, and you just feel different when you're early, especially when the other person is running late. When you're early, you get to arrive, you get to set your coat down, you get to, you know, read through some reading materials, plan for the rest of your day, have a coffee, be relaxed, and you get to be the person in control. You're the person who was there on time. And when the person shows up, they're apologizing to you, they're acquiescing to you, they're being deferential to you, because they've obviously automatically done something wrong. So the way that that interaction, when it has started off with an imbalance where one person is basically in control and has all the positive adjectives that are associated with punctual people, and the other person has started off the day or the interaction with negativity or negative adjectives, with being apologetic, with having to be subservient or like deferential to sort of make up for their lateness, there's an unequal exchange of power. And while it might be okay in safe spaces where it's your friend, for example, who probably, you know, is used to you not being on time, in other circumstances, it does affect how other people perceive you, especially in situations where the stakes are higher, like at work, for example. It does matter if your colleagues and your manager and other people just in general experience you as somebody who doesn't stick to their word, as somebody who is perpetually late, as somebody who always has like another excuse as to why they missed their train or couldn't show up on time. That's not a neutral effect, and it's not as though those people aren't internalizing how they feel about you negatively. And also, you can see it in their expression. You can see it in how they interact with you. You can feel it in how you have to make yourself small and apologetic because you've been late. All those things have an effect on your self-esteem and your identity, and also in the power relations between you and the other people that you show up late for. Another thing is being well prepared. It's different to being punctual. So being punctual includes being prepared in that you've, you know, thought about your clothes and what you're going to wear and where you're going to be. But being prepared is different in that, so for example, when you've got an interview, you're excited about a new job, you went through the effort of applying, you've submitted your CV and your covering letter, you've done the research about the company, so you've done a lot of the legwork, and then the interview is your final stage to sort of bring it all together and sell yourself to the company, and also suss out whether they're the right fit for you. But one of the best things you can do to feel powerful, to feel like you walk into that interview commanding the space, is doing the preparation. So it's going over your CV, going over your covering letter, making sure you know everything about the company, making sure you know who's interviewing you, making sure that you have an idea of what the expectation, the cultural expectation, and the qualifications are going to want to focus on. When you know you have all that covered, then it doesn't really matter so much what happens in the interview, because you can react to it. So if they ask you a question that's not exactly how you anticipated the question being asked, if you've done lots of prep work, you can basically pivot and still make it fit. Or if you walk in and you generally feel like there's an odd aura about them, your vibes just don't click with that person, it doesn't really matter. You're not going to let that put you off, because you're still going to power through, because ultimately you know all the things that you're going to do. And that's the same thing with like preparation when it comes to like going to like university classes and having done the readings before you show up to class. It's the same with when you're supposed to speak at a wedding, for example, and you haven't just waited till like the last minute to prepare the speech. You've actually gone through the effort of getting it ready on time so that you're in control. The way that you feel about yourself in that space feels radically different. And the way that other people experience you in that space also feels very radically different. And the difference between being prepared and not being prepared is actually, for me, a power thing, in that you feel powerful, you feel in control, you feel on a level pegging, and you feel like no matter what happens in that space when you're well prepared, it's not going to knock your self-esteem or your confidence, because, you know, what can they throw at you that you didn't anticipate already? What question can they ask you that you haven't really prepared for, or that even if the question isn't exactly right, like let's say, for example, you're doing a presentation. You've been asked to prepare a presentation. You've prepped it for weeks. You've rehearsed it to the point where you don't even need your notes. You have your notes there as a prop, but you really don't need them. Even if somebody should ask you a question that's a bit left field, you've already created such an impeccable impression from delivering the presentation so well and from coming across as though you know your stuff very well. So if somebody should ask you one question that throws you off slightly, you already have so much grace that you've bought yourself from being well prepared. And that's also true when like a lecturer asks you a question you didn't anticipate knowing that. If you've been participating in the other classes because you show up on time, having read what you had to read, having written what you had to write, then even if you have like an off moment, it doesn't knock you in the same way, or it doesn't knock your confidence in the same way as being somebody who is perceived perpetually as being unprepared or being underprepared. Other things that we can control is there's a few things I've just generally thought about under the heading of self-deception. So a lot of the time, we actually know the truth, but for some reason, we convince ourselves that the truth doesn't apply to us or doesn't apply to the circumstance. And the way that manifests in everyday life is, for example, like, we know that looks matter in all kinds of ways. You know, there's loads of studies that show that better looking people, for example, are more likely to be employed. They're more likely to get promotions. We know that it's going to affect the relationships that you get into. It also affects the kinds of relationships and the income of the partners that you have. It also affects even friendships, how friends, you think that it's only looks only matter when it comes to romantic relationships, but looks even matter when it comes to like how your friends feel about you or how friends end up connecting in the first place. Because if you think about it, a lot of the time, the way that people first interact with you or notice you is really how you show up in the world and how you present. So sometimes it might be because somebody is drawn to you from a platonic friendship way because they saw you give like a speech and they were like, wow, that person is so interesting. I love their thoughts and I want to get to know them. Or it might be they saw you perform and they think that person is so talented, or they heard you speak in class and they thought that person is really articulate or is a real critical thinker, and that's what draws you to them. Sometimes that's the case, but other times it's just that you're at a social gathering and they just happen to think that you are well put together or that you come across well. But the way that you look always factors in no matter what people tell you. Now, in the context of relationships, we obviously all know that in the early stages, looks matter, because when you see somebody across the room and you like how they look, you don't think, wow, their personalities are really shining from across the way. No, like maybe sometimes that's the case, but a lot of the time it's actually you just inherently like the way that person looks, because usually when people are single and they're out and about, they usually make more of an effort to be alluring to the partners that they desire. So they're dressed better, they'll take care of their skin better, they'll be more likely to be working out because they're trying to attract basically a partner. So it matters in the early stages, and dating, like anybody who's ever been on a dating platform, like, I mean, back in the day, I was on Plenty of Fish, but I don't think that exists anymore. If you're on Tinder or Hinge or whatever dating app you choose, or Bumble, you know that looks matter. And that's why people spend time really cultivating the right image. They'll take a million photos. They'll choose the ones that display them as athletic or flirtatious or whatever. They'll put an effort into the image they choose because they understand that that's the first and only interaction or opportunity to make an impact on the person who's looking at you. But somehow when it comes to relationships, people forget that as time goes by. So at the beginning, we understand that people, it's not even about superficiality. It's part of being with somebody is having a sexual attraction to somebody, and part of sexual attraction is obviously people's looks. So it's not to diminish the point, but people forget as relationships go on that that person still has a type. They are still attracted to people who look like the way you looked when you first met them. So what happens when you get with somebody and then as time goes by, you decide, actually, you know what? It doesn't matter as much to stay in shape because that person loves me. It doesn't matter if I put on like some weight because that person loves me. It doesn't matter if I don't look after my personal hygiene, like getting my hair done or going to the dentist and getting like a clean or shaving or wearing nice perfume or just appearing put together. So when they see you around the house, you just look nice. They forget that. And then as time goes by, when the sexual attraction wanes, or when the person doesn't treat you like you're their darling anymore, they don't seem enamored by you anymore, they don't have that twinkle in their eye for you, sometimes we go to the big stuff like, well, maybe it's because it's a fundamental incompatibility between us. Maybe it's because of built up resentment. Sometimes we go to all those big things, but sometimes it actually is just the small bits. It's we've stopped doing the small things that matter in terms of sustaining romance and attraction and eliciting sexual desire from your long-term partner. And it might be the case that it also is just the big stuff, but one of the things is just to cover your bases and to make sure that you aren't taking yourself for granted, your relationship for granted, your partnership for granted by underestimating what we know to be true, in that looks matter in all other areas of our lives. So there's no reason why it shouldn't apply to our long-term relationships. And it doesn't mean that the partner doesn't love us anymore, but we all know there can be a difference between somebody loving you and somebody desiring you, or somebody loving you and somebody being in love with you. And sometimes it is because we've stopped doing the small things that made them be attracted to us from across the room without knowing anything about us, namely our looks, essentially. Another thing that falls under the umbrella of self-deception is kind of kidding ourselves into believing that money doesn't matter, or money doesn't impact how we feel about ourselves and also how people interact with us. So for example, in relationships, when you first meet somebody, money doesn't matter so much in the sense that you are so enamored by the person, about how they look, about what your life could be together, about the feelings that you inspire in them and they inspire in you, that money really is only comes into effect as the relationship goes on. So it isn't until you start thinking about living with that person, about starting a family with that person, about buying a home with that person, or even just taking big milestones, like taking your first big trip, or, you know, that's when money comes into effect, in that it only matters when it's an unequal exchange. Especially when people, and this only applies when people are making very similar money. So if you're both on like 45K, for example, then there's an expectation that you're both going to contribute to your life together financially in a way that's on par. Obviously, it's different if one person makes 100K and the other person makes like 35K, 40K. Then, of course, the person who's making like six figures is going to carry the burden, or is going to shoulder a lot of that cost. But for the most part, most people are in partnerships where that's not the case. Like, they tend to earn level pegging money, especially when they're like sub 40, because there's a big change in trajectory of income when in straight relationships, when the woman starts to have children, because obviously she has to stay home. So outside of that, though, if we think that the money we spend in the relationship doesn't impact how our partner feels about us, it's just a lie. There's only so many times that somebody's going to treat you to dinner before they start being resentful of the fact that you never offered to pay. Or if you share a home with somebody, there's only so much they're going to spend on the house, of like buying carpets, buying mirrors, buying furniture, buying beds, you know, or even just like buying the weekly shop, the weekly grocery shop. If you never put your hand in your own pockets to offer to pay for things and to feel as though you are concerned about those things, over time, the person does become less attracted to you and become more resentful of you. And it is going to impact the sustainability or the stability of the relationship, because one person is going to feel as though you are taking them for a ride. And also, it's going to erode the respect, the basic respect that they have for you. And this is not just even in romantic contexts. Even when you think about just going out with friends, when you go out with a friend for dinner, if you are the one who always offers to pay and they don't stop you and say, no, don't be ridiculous, you've gotten it the last two times, please let me treat you, over time, you're going to think less of them, even though you're the one who's offering to pay. The natural expectation is that there's going to be some level of reciprocity, because you basically don't want to think that the person is either leeching off you, to use that, if I want to use that term, or just is bummy. You don't want to think the person is bummy, that they don't have basic social skills to know that, you know, it does matter that both people are contributing to the relationship financially too. The final component under the self-deception umbrella, before I move on to the bigger things, is also when it comes time to consider how people around you treat you. Because sometimes, I've had this experience where you meet different friends, and sometimes you feel like you're meeting the same type of friend with the same type of issues over and over again. And each time you meet that person, initially, it doesn't strike you that that's the same person you previously experienced and didn't like, because obviously, to some extent, you don't know, or you're not aware, or you're not thinking about why you are quote unquote attracting the same type of person over and over again. And in the early stages, it's very tempting to always externalize the blame and say, you know, Things like, why do I always attract people who are jealous of me? Or why do I always attract people who don't wish me well? Or why do I always attract people who aren't supportive or aren't compassionate or aren't kind or aren't generous? Whatever the particular issue is with the same person you keep meeting over and over again. And when you're externalizing the problem, so you're saying, it's a problem with all these people who are coming into my life that they happen to share the same characteristic. Obviously, what's going on there is that you're ignoring the part where you are an active contributor in all these relationships, and also that you're the common denominator. So all those people who happen to have been drawn to you have been drawn to that same person, i.e. you, and therefore the explanatory variable, if you will, is not them, but it's actually you. Like, the outcome ends up being the same because the input is the same each time, the input being you. So self-deception in this context is choosing to believe that it just happens to be coincidence or fate or bad luck that all these people who end up over time being the same person that you are running away from, the self-deception essentially saying that it's them and not you. It definitely is you. And actually, that's a pretty empowering position, because if it's them and they end up bamboozling you each time and you never see it coming, then it means you're always at the mercy of these strangers that come into your life, and you just, you know, you hope for the best, you expect the best, you're your usual delightful self, but then they end up snaking you over and over again. That's a pretty helpless position to be in. Whereas when you recognize that you are the common denominator and therefore you are doing something that attracts that kind of person or that type of person into your life over and over again, then you actually see you've got the capacity to change them. Because presumably, if you change the way you're approaching things or change the way you are being with these people or the kinds of messaging you're communicating to them, then you're going to get a different outcome. And that's a pretty empowering position to be in. Now, moving on to the bigger things, and when I was thinking about what those small, big things are, one of the things that stands out to me is the idea of betraying your ideals. And ideals are obviously different from person to person, but they're basically just beliefs or ideals that you hold for yourself, or that are kind of important in how you view yourself, and therefore the esteem that you have for yourself. And it's generally like positive things. So let's say, for example, you identify somebody who is just fundamentally on a basic level an honest person, or you're somebody who can't be bought, or you see somebody who is a protector and defends the weak, or somebody who stands up to injustice. That's an example of ideals that we hold for ourselves. And the thing about ideals is, no matter how difficult it is to uphold them or to do what you feel is right for you or to do with something that you said that you would always do in that situation, no matter what the circumstances are, you could end up in jail, you could end up losing a relationship or losing money or losing your job. But when those bad things happen, because you stood up for your ideals, it actually has the net effect of making you feel more emboldened and more powerful and more positive, because ultimately, you know that you were able to stand up and you're willing to stand up for what you believe is right, what your ideals are, even in the face of very difficult challenges that many people might make a different decision in. And the reason for that is that it's in a way reinforcing the ideal. So let's say you're somebody who defends the weak. When you are, let's say, an example where the person who is the bully is somebody who holds a lot of power. Let's say it's your boss, If they are bullying somebody and you see that bullying taking place and you stand up for what's right in that moment, or you find a way to, you know, get a positive outcome for the person who's bullied by going to HR or rallying your colleagues or writing a letter to HR on their behalf, then even if you should lose your job or some other negative consequence will happen to you, you will feel pretty smug in that you went down fighting for what's right. And more importantly, fighting for what you said was an ideal to you that you were willing to maintain even in the face of difficult situations. Now, the reverse is much worse. The opposite is much worse, in that you basically die 1,000 deaths when you betray your ideals, because one, ideals tend to be set pretty early on in life and they kind of guide a lot of the way that we show up in the world. So people, for example, who don't embrace materialism, you can feel the way it oozes out of them, in that it feels like a long held belief that they have carried with them for a very long time. And so when they're espousing things or doing things that communicate that ideal, it doesn't feel like it's just a surface level thing. It feels like it's intrinsic to how they are, who they are, and how they identify. And so if it is so fundamental to who the person is, then betraying that ideal must also have a fundamental effect on how they perceive themselves and must really knock their confidence. And it knocks their confidence because if you are somebody who's gone around talking about how you abhor bullying, and then a situation arises, a public situation arises where you don't stand up for somebody who's being bullied, then you are telling the other people around you that you actually don't mean what you say. And that ideal, that positive attribute or positive identity you had cultivated in the eyes of others, obviously erodes because you can no longer maintain that facade, because now it becomes a facade because people see you when the moment counts not living out that truth. Or even if others don't find out, you have to live with the knowledge of what you did. So one of the things that stands out to me, for example, that I still think about to this day is when I was in secondary school, I was like in the middle. I wasn't like one of the cool kids. I wasn't a complete nerd. I was kind of a nerd that also like did naughty things, if you will. So I was like in the middle. So I could hang out with like lots of different types of people, lots of different types of groups. And one day I walk into history class and there's this, like this guy called Donal who, he had a little bit of a learning difficulty. And you could tell that in that when he was being bullied, sometimes he didn't understand that being bullied was what was happening. And in this case, I walk in, there's this girl called Shannon, and she's actually very little. She's very little petite, but she has a very big voice, and she's also very popular with like the really bad kids. And so she's standing on the table, and this is before the teacher walked in. She's standing on the table, and she's taking Donald's pencil case, and she's basically making him jump for it. And he was like a bigger kid as well, and he was getting flustered and sweaty, and you could see he was just getting very agitated. And while she's making him jump for his pencil case, like, you know, humiliating him essentially, all the other kids, the other bad kids, and the other kids were also kind of like quiet, were kind of like laughing along and basically mocking Donal and what Shannon was doing to Donal. And in that moment, I remember feeling this intense feeling of shame because I knew what I should be doing in that situation. I should have gone, taken the pencil case from Shannon and said, like, what are you doing? And given it back to Donal. That would have been an example of me living through like how I identify as somebody who will not stand by and let somebody else get bullied. And obviously I've learned from that mistake and that now, you know, it makes me sick to my stomach and I wouldn't let it go. But that stayed with me all these years. It's been 15 years and it has stayed with me because it was a moment of self-betrayal. It's a moment of betraying an ideal that I held up for myself, and it affected my self-confidence to some extent because I know that that's not who I am. And I also know that I allowed, you know, a teenager to be bullied in front of everybody when actually the social cost to me would have been very minimal because I hung out with so many different types of people and so many groups. If I had just taken her pencil case and been like, oh, stop it, or even made light of it, oh, like, you know, just stop bothering him, I wouldn't have been like the target of the bullying. It wouldn't have been a big deal. It would have just been like, oh, you know, I've ruined the fun, but that would have been the extent of it. But I still would have carried out basically what I believe to be right. So that's an example of how little things like betraying yourself in small ways stays with you in a way that standing up for what's right also stays with you, except that one is associated with being courageous, being brave, reinforcing the ideal and the identity that you have for yourself. And the other one comes with shame and knowing that you did something wrong. And in this circumstance, in that scenario that I just described, obviously there are other people to witness it. But even when other people don't witness what has just happened, because you are always talking to yourself in your, like, you know, you've got an internal monologue that takes place and you're living life in your mind in a way and you're perceiving yourself and you know exactly what's happening, like, in, you know, internally, you can't hide from yourself. You can't run from yourself. So even when other people don't know, you still know. And what happens when you falter on an ideal that you've held for yourself repeatedly? Another example, for example, is when people are in relationships that don't serve them. Let's say they have said they would never, let's say you grew up in a home where you saw that your family, that your parents weren't kind to each other. They weren't affectionate with each other. They weren't loving towards each other. They're really basically in an unhappy relationship. And they stayed in a way where, to some extent, you hope that they... You kind of wish that it would have been better for the family if they'd split up and they could both have been happy in their respective relationships that followed. You grow up in that scenario, you realize the harm it does, you realize the dysfunction of that scenario, and you say to yourself, I will never be in a relationship in which I don't feel valued or loved, or there's no love and there's no affection and there's no safety there. If you say that to yourself and then you find yourself in that situation and you bring, God forbid, you bring a family into that situation, then that's going to have an outsized effect on your self-esteem and your sense of identity, because you're going against something that you know better, and you're going against something that you always said to yourself you were never going to do. And there's a certain level of pain that comes from doing or making the wrong decisions when you know better, especially when you've experienced what it feels like to live in that's like the scenario that I just described. So it really feels like a death by a thousand cuts, because every day that you stay in that relationship, you're constantly just being reminded of what you said you wouldn't do. You're communicating to the other people that you've said that to, that you're obviously somebody who doesn't mean what they say or isn't able to uphold those things. And also what it does is it makes you less able to be courageous in other areas. So when you're, for example, afraid to make the right call for yourself because you fear the consequences, there's no way you're going to be fearful in one scenario and make decisions that are against your ideals or against what's even good for you, and make that in the full knowledge of that, because you're aware that that's happening in real time. And all that has a real knock-on effect on your identity, especially when other people are there to witness that betrayal of self, if you will. And what that means is that next time you're in the same situation where the situation calls for bravery, you're going to falter, because you know the last time you were in that same situation, you weren't able to act. Whereas when you do act with bravery or courage or even just basic decisiveness, what you're communicating to yourself is you're that kind of person. You're the kind of person when decisions are needed to be taken, when you need to make a call for the people around you in a way that benefits the intended person, that you make the right call, you make the right decision, and you do that without cowardice, you do that without betraying yourself. And that means next time you're presented with the same scenario, next time you have to be brave, next time you have to be courageous, next time you have to be a commanding person or exercise some power or exercise some agency or advocate for yourself to do what's, you know, best for you. Because you've had all those previous experiences where you do exactly that and it has had an outcome that has, you know, reinforce that ideal that you have for yourself, it's going to make it that much easier to act in those ways in the future. And all the things I've described so far in the episode, whether we're talking about, you know, the small things like about being punctual, about being well prepared, about not engaging in self-deception, all those things may seem small, or they may seem like they don't affect the landscape of your life. But actually, in terms of the things that you can influence or can control, they're very impactful in that they affect how you view yourself. And ultimately, how we view ourselves is really the agency, or it's really the energy that propels us forward in all other areas of our lives. So if I feel like I am a person who sticks to my word, if I feel like I'm a person who's in control of my life, I control the things I can control. When I say I'm going to be somewhere, I end up being there. When I say I'm going to produce a work to a certain standard, I produce it to a certain standard. When I say I'm going to be well prepared for something that I've committed to, I am that person. When I don't engage in actions of self-deception, where I betray what I know to be the truth to myself, because it's easier to accept, when I don't engage in those behaviors, it shapes the kind of person that I view myself in, or the lens through which I view myself. And all those ways are positive ways, because they're ways that make me realize that even if I don't have control of where I'm born, what family I'm born into, what era I'm born into, I, at the very least, have some agency over the small things that impact how other people interact with me on a daily basis, and also just how I view myself and the identity and the ideals that I hold for myself. And that's no small thing. That's actually in the grand scheme of things, all that matters is, not all that matters, maybe that's a bit blasé, but certainly one of the things that matters the most, or shapes our reality, is how we feel about ourselves and the level of agency that we feel that we have, and also being able to live up to the kind of person we aspire to be. And that's why it's ultimately good to sweat the small stuff. Like, these things do matter. They're not trivial. They may be trivial in the context of the other things you can control that I talked about, but they're not trivial in the sense that they have real life consequences on how you view yourself and how the world interacts with you. And with that wraps up this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I'll catch you in the next one.